Hello and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you've left for me in the comments section of my Q&A videos or have sent to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. This is episode number 49, and I'm sort of wondering, planning, thinking about what to do next week for episode number 50, since, you know, 50 is such a magic number. Anyway, we'll see what happens with that. I wanted to remind everybody out there, or let people know who might be newly coming to the channel, that the audiobook version of my book, Scientology A to Xenu, An Insider's Guide to What Scientology is Really All About, is now available on Audible and on Amazon.com and on iTunes. So if you didn't know that, then now you do, and you can go get it and hear my wonderful self reading my book to you. So anyway, we have a lot of very interesting questions this week, so let's get to it. Kiva Go. Chris, I like to hear the minutiae of processes. So could you give any fun or absurd examples you experienced of rollbacking and or the truth rundown that may illuminate dynamics between passing the buck to the source of N-theta someone does a KR on and the self-blame game? Well, let me talk about my first example of getting what's called a rollback, and I'll explain what that is, and maybe that'll help answer this question. When I was staff in Santa Barbara, back at the Church of Scientology of Santa Barbara, back in the late 80s and early 90s, before I joined the Sea Org, there was an issue that came down from Chairman of the Board, RTC, David Miscavige, who had announced tax exemption, and that was pretty much all my experience with the man in 93. So I think this was in 94. I think this was the next year, or maybe a little later after, maybe late 93, early 94, I think. And this issue that came down was a technical point. It had to do with, I won't get into the specifics of it, but it had to do with something that is done to help set up an auditing session with the meter and the cans and everything in Scientology. Miscavige was saying that everybody was doing this particular step wrong, and he was laying out why they were doing it wrong, how they were doing it wrong, and that every single person in the world who was trained on an e-meter had to redo the drills, the practical, practice of doing this particular step. They had to do it over again because they didn't get it right. And they were doing it, in fact, horribly wrong. And so everyone in the world had to redo this. And I was like, one, who's David Miscavige to tell me that? And two, I didn't think I was doing it wrong. So I, I kind of got the point of the issue, but I was like, yeah, okay, whatever. And so I did what you're supposed to do when you get an order in Scientology that you don't feel is correct or just or right, which is I wrote an orders query back to David Miscavige, querying the order. I was like, I don't feel this is necessary. I don't feel the need to do this. And this seems to me to be a violation of another policy that Hubbard wrote called inspection before the fact, right? Which is Hubbard wrote this policy that said that if something's working or moving or going along at a good clip and everything's fine with it, then don't step in and try to mess around with it or screw around with it, because you're just going to screw it up. You're going to make it work, make it not work anymore. And so this was, in other words, you don't inspect something to find out what's wrong until after the fact of something going wrong, right? Which is not to say you don't do quality control or you don't keep up on things, but it's actually, not a bad point. If something's working fine, leave it the hell alone, right? Don't, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? It's basically the policy. So I was using that as a basis of querying this order, because I said, well, I'm not broke, so why are you trying to fix me, right? Well, the response to this was two representatives from RTC came to Santa Barbara within about 2 or 3 days of me sending this orders query. And they were there in their full Sea Org uniforms and everything in order to set me straight and set the whole org straight on this point. Because who am I to query an order from David Miscavige, right? And of course, when I was still a staff member in Santa Barbara, this had quite an effect on me. Two Sea Org members showing up who were They were not messing around. They weren't there to be warm and fuzzy and cuddly. They were there to kick my ass, right? And they weren't yelling or screaming. They were like, yeah, we're going to deal with this. You know, yeah, you just have no idea what you're talking about, and we're going to deal with this, right? And the first thing they did was this woman took me up to an auditing room, put me on the meter, and she did what's called a rollback. Now, I could do a whole video on this, but basically a rollback is an investigation. It's a way of doing an investigation. And what you're trying to do is, Hubbard says that if you have someone, like a suppressive person, right, or a suppressive group, like the Sykes or the FBI or the IRS or some group that's anti-Scientology, let's say, or some individual who's anti-Scientology, that person will spew lines. They will say things, right, that are against Scientology. They're called enemy lines, okay, because they're an enemy, and these are the lines, these are the words that are coming out of their mouths. And these lines are phrases, basically. An enemy line is a phrase or a sentence or a concept that's communicated that is supposed to encapsulate an idea that would create disaffection or upset or doubt or fear or uncertainty on the part of the person who receives the enemy line. So in this particular case, before we get back to that. So what you do in what's called a rollback is there's this procedure where you put the person on a meter, somebody who, not the SP, you're trying to find the SP. You're trying to find out, where did this line come from? Where did this enemy line come from? Like you have a staff member who says, you know, staff never get paid, right? Now, it happens to be true, but to run around spewing that line creates disaffection. It creates upset, right? And the one thing they don't like in Scientology are critical remarks or statements that make people doubt or be uncertain about Scientology. So, you know, if somebody said staff don't get paid, who would want to join staff? Nobody would want to join staff, right? Why would they? Because they're not going to get paid. And the whole line when you recruit somebody is, of course you'll get paid, and you'll get paid, you know, as hard as you work is proportional to how much you'll get paid, right? Which is total horseshit. Staff don't get paid ever, like anything. Like it's so, like this, these, you know, the number of times I got paid more than $100, I think I could literally count on one hand for the, you know, 8 or 9 years that I was staff at Santa Barbara. So it is definitely true that staff don't get paid. But to run around saying that, it's not okay. So the when a person's put on the meter who is saying these things, if nobody thinks that that person is an SP, a suppressive person, a bad person, right, then they will ask the person, where did you get the idea that staff don't get paid, right? Where'd you get the idea to talk about that, to say that? And the person who's doing the investigation is supposed to roll back this line that this person has, because according to Hubbard, somebody fed it to him. Somebody gave him that line. Somebody made him think that. And the purpose of a rollback is to find out who that person was. And then go get that person and put them on the meter and do the same drill with them. Where did you get the idea? You know, you told Chris that staff don't get paid, or whatever it is that he said. Maybe he said, maybe Chris is running around saying staff don't get paid, and it actually goes back to Bill, and Bill told Chris, well, you know, Hubbard created a payroll system that ensures nobody gets paid, right? Maybe that was how that line came to Chris, right? And so they go grab Bill, and they sit him down, and they go, where'd you get this idea that Hubbard created a payroll system that nobody is ever going to get paid, right? And they get him to cough up on, you know, he has to go, oh, you know, I had that idea when I didn't get paid. And they go, yeah, okay, but where'd you get that idea? Who gave you that idea? Who? It's not where did you get the idea, like, from life or from your experiences. It's who gave you that idea? Who said that, right? It's all about finding the sources of rumors or rumor lines or enemy lines, right? And according to Hubbard, the idea is that somebody originated that. Somebody said that first. There's some person who started what Hubbard calls a black PR campaign against Scientology. And the idea is to trace it back to the person who first said it and declare them, you know, show them up to be suppressive people and get rid of them so that they're not around anymore to spread their fear, uncertainty, and doubt, right? So, coming back to this experience with David Miscavige's orders, right, back in 93, this RTC person sits me down and says, so where did you get the idea to, you know, query an order from David Miscavige? And I'm like, L. Ron Hubbard policy, you know, like that's what it says to do. And she's like, yeah, yeah. And she goes, yeah, yeah, but where, what about David Miscavige? Where'd you get the idea that David Miscavige is not, you know, is, and I was like, well, David Miscavige is not a tech person. He's the RTC COB, right? Chairman of the board RTC. He's not some guy who's supposed to be telling me what to do with Scientology tech, right? It's not his job. Yeah, but where'd you get that idea, right? Where did this idea come from? Just all curious, has me on the meter looking for, yeah, what's that? What's that thought right there? What's that, right? And I'm like, you know, this is the first time this has ever happened to me. I'm kind of like, you know, I don't know. You know, I actually am sitting here right now and I don't actually totally remember what that went back to. It certainly did not go back to, although, I mean, we went around and around on this for about an hour trying to find, you know, where this idea came from that it was okay for me to send a query to an order from David Miscavige. And I think the reason I took this up and wanted to talk about this was not so much to tell you who the SP was or who the person was that I got this idea from, because that wasn't how it, you know, that's how Hubbard says it's supposed to be. That's not how it was. I was actually doing exactly what L. Ron Hubbard told me to do. And I thought this might be illustrative of how Scientology will twist, right? People in Scientology will take something Hubbard says and use it in a twisted fashion to create a mindset through the context of what they're doing to make you doubt what you have actually read from L. Ron Hubbard, right? So it's bad enough, all the things L. Ron Hubbard ever said to do, because he said to do all kinds of crap and all kinds of nonsense in his policies about how to run organizations. And it is true that staff don't get paid, right? And that is a direct reflection of L. Ron Hubbard's complete incompetence and inefficiency as an administrator and as a manager. He set this system up to fail for the staff. Right? All the money from the churches are supposed to go funnel up to him. And so any policies, any directives, anything you hear from L. Ron Hubbard saying staff are supposed to get paid is total nonsense, right? It's just not true. But as a good staff member, as a loyal staff member, you listen to L. Ron Hubbard and you're supposed to believe this stuff. And then on top of that, you get David Miscavige, who's twisting things around even worse. And he uses this Hubbard rollbacking to twist your mind around even harder. It's even more of a pretzel by the time you're done with this, because I walked out of that interview questioning my entire life, right? Like, what, where did I get this idea? And David Miscavige, and clearly here's these two people from RTC who were like, you know, on me about this. I mean, they weren't messing around. And if I had made trouble or said, fuck you guys, you know, you guys are full of shit, right? Pardon my French, but if I had said that, their response would have been to, you know, slap me down and make me the suppressive person, right? I was in trouble. I mean, make no mistake. So I was very much trying to cooperate with this entire activity and trying to be good, right? And trying to be cooperative and trying to get my wits around what was going on that I did wrong, because here's the thing, I didn't do anything wrong, but I was made to feel I did something wrong and had my mind twisted around this pretzel because this was a procedure, this rollback thing was something L. Ron Hubbard said to do. He's the one who came up with the whole idea. So RTC takes this and uses it to twist things around. So that's what I thought this might be you know, a good example of. And, you know, the end result of it doesn't really matter. I got slapped down. I got, you know, all kinds of like twisty, ugh. And then they sat me down and made me do this technical procedure and proved to me that I didn't know how to do it, which was not true because I did know how to do it. But the guy was on me in such a way that he made me think I didn't because he was giving me a real hard time. And then they, you know, now with everybody all confused and now the one thing that none of us, here's the thing, here's the end result of this. The one thing that I and every other staff member at Santa Barbara Org was absolutely convinced of by the time those two left was to never, ever question an order from David Miscavige. And that was the actual true end result of that little project from those two people from RTC. So if you're wondering how it works, how they do what they do, there's a good example of it. And I thought this question was a good chance for me to give you that example. So there you go. Pie Wacket 33. Chris, what differences, if any, have you seen between people who joined Scientology as an adult, young children who were brought into Scientology via their parents joining, and those born into Scientology? Is it the same for those born into and those who were young children when their parents joined? And also, if you have any observations, any differences between the three groups as ex-Scientologists in terms of recovery ease or difficulty, letting go of the cult, ability or desire to speak out publicly, ability to lead a happy, fulfilled life beyond Scientology. Any thoughts? Thanks and love this series. Wow, you don't really ask much, do you? This is like a, let's do an entire psychological and sociological study on all ex-Scientologists, right? I'm just going to really gloss this one over, give you some brief, you know, examples of what I've observed with this. I fall into the second category where I wasn't born into it, but my parents got in so when I was still so young that I might as well have been. I think honestly, you know, for me to answer this question really honestly, I have to tell you that I can't. Everybody is so different with this stuff. But in general terms, I think that those who came into Scientology, you know, after they were born, those who willingly got in on their own bat, so to speak, tend to be the ones who are more convinced of the veracity of Scientology. They're more hardcore. They're the diehards of Scientology, I think. Now, you know, I say that as this broad generality because you can find examples of diehard Scientologists who were people who were born into it. So, you know, so that's the danger of talking about broad generalities like this is you can find examples in each of these three categories you name of diehards, middle of the roads, and yeah, never really so involved. That's the truth, right? Actual percentages of these groups within these three categories, I can't tell you. I don't know. But in general terms, from my own experience, I think that those who got in on their own bat tend to be more convinced, more hardcore, more dedicated. When they bring their children into it, like I was, or their people were born into it, right? Second generation, third generation, now fourth generation Scientologists. You get a mindset of somebody who doesn't ever have any other experience. That they, you know, Scientology has defined their life growing up as a child and then into adulthood. And, well, I interviewed Shane Waitman, right? And I did a 5-part interview with him, which is exactly the person who was born into it, right? And he grew up until he was, you know, 17, 18, 19 years old. He joined staff. He worked at London Org. He was as hardcore as you could get. Like, he didn't have any other reality except Scientology until somebody gave him a different reality, somebody he cared about, right? A woman that he met that he fell in love with, and she showed him that Scientology was not really everything that he thought it was. So you can change that, you know, that self-identity that a person is raised with as a Scientologist by exposing them to truth, right? And then putting them under the pressure that Scientology puts people under. So I don't know that there's really a more or less hardcore Scientologist, really, because each person reacts individually to it. And honestly, that's the best answer I can give you on it from my own experience. Val Afuelo Conway. I'm fascinated with what aspects of pop culture you may have missed while you were in the Sea Org. Were you able to watch TV shows, listen to the radio, go to the movies? Did you miss all of the music of the 90s? Did you know about the O.J. Simpson trial? Did you miss the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center? The Columbia Space Shuttle explosion? Monica Lewinsky? No, I didn't really miss any of those things. I joined the Sea Org in 1995. And, of course, when 9/11 happened, for example, I remember to this day exactly where I was when I first heard about it that morning. I was in the shower, and somebody was like, oh my God, the World Trade Center is blowing up, right? And I was like, what? And that day, you know, I happened to be around the news because I worked in management, Scientology management, and we you know, had some lines to outside news sources. So let me just say in a broad sense, people in the Sea Org can and do read the newspapers and magazines, and they do listen to the radio, maybe not while they're working. And that is where the control is really entered in, is you're doing your job all day and night. So the only time you have to be exposed to outside media is in your own time, and that's a very little amount of time when you're in the Sea Org. That's mornings when you're eating your breakfast. I saw people reading the newspapers then. We didn't have any TVs, but we did see sports events sometimes, right? Super Bowl or World Series, things like that. They'd put a TV up in the main mess while we were eating, and we could watch parts of the game and whatnot. But we didn't watch the news, right? That never happened. You had, after work, after you were done at night, you know, you could go home, read a book, listen to the radio, something like that. Nobody was particularly stopping anybody from doing that, but I never really was too interested in listening to the radio when I went home at night. I was more interested in, you know, going to bed. You were made aware of major events that happened. Monica Lewinsky, not so much. I think that was while I was a staff member that happened. But the, you know, O.J. Simpson trial, that sort of thing, I knew that those things were happening, but it's distant. And here, and in addition to what I just said about the scheduling, here's another aspect of this that might give you some insight into the life of a Sea Org member. You don't care. You know, these things that go on in pop culture don't matter to Sea Org members. Really, they just don't care. Because those things that are going on in the real world are what we would call the WOG world, right? That's going on out there. That's the crazy. That's the reactive mind. That's the stuff that's going on that we're trying to deal with. We're trying to change people so that they don't do those things, right? And we felt like we were in a rat race. We felt like we were in a race against time to change the civilization before these things that go on in pop culture, like 9/11, would destroy us all, right? So all those things did, the more amazing or spectacular or horrible the event was, right? Like spectacular in a bad way, right? The more we felt an incentive to work harder to get Scientology to people in the real world so that they would become part of the Scientology world and would stop doing those things. And that was sort of our attitude about that stuff. So we weren't really very interested in getting all the dirty down low on all of the Monica Lewinsky stuff or the, you know, the space shuttle blowing up was like, oh yeah, that sucks. Well, guess they're going to go get some new bodies and start all over again. And, you know, yeah, sucks the space shuttle blew up. That's horrible. And that's about the attitude, right? Is if somebody dies or a bunch of people die, Scientologists just believe in reincarnation. They believe that those people are going to go to a hospital as spiritual beings, pick up new baby bodies, and start all over again. So that has a lot to do with why they might come across like there's not a lot of compassion. It's because they don't think that death is the end of anything. They think it just, you know, the person's just going to come back around again. And when you have that point of view and you feel that that's the certainty of how things are, a lot of the significance and importance and tragedy of bad things that happen kind of goes away, you know? It's still a tragedy. I mean, it's not like anybody's jumping up and down because a bunch of kids get shot at a school shooting, but it's not like they're, you know, devastated by that kind of an event, right? The Sea Org just look at that event and go, crazy shooter, probably was on psych drugs. Those damn psychs are still at it, and we have to work harder to prevent those psychs from passing out their pills and creating these school shooters, right? And that was literally, that entire thought I just encapsulated is about the entire thought process Scientologists pay to, like, school shootings or bombings or explosions or bad things that happen like that. So, at least in my experience, right, especially as a Sea Org member, staff members, they're closer to it, they're more in the real world, they're more real, they have more of a realistic attitude about world events because they're more exposed to them. And public Scientologists, well, they're flat out in the real world just as much as anybody else. So you might see shades of what I was talking about with them, but they'll be more understanding and more aware and more in the know or in the loop on what's going on in the world. And that's kind of between those three tiers of public, staff, Sea Org, that's kind of how that breaks down. Nikki XOXO, do most Scientology members live in these buildings because most of them work almost all the day? You said that the salary is just a few dollars, so how do they buy food, clothes, and all that stuff? Does Scientology give support so the members don't look like poor people for PR? Your question specifically addresses the Sea Org, because staff members at a Scientology church, like Denver or Oslo or St. Hill or, you know, London, like these city churches, those are staffed by staff members, right? Those are called Class 5 orgs. They don't have clothes provided to them. They don't have food provided to them. They have a very, very tiny amount of pay that they get, as I mentioned earlier. So they almost exclusively all have other jobs that support them, that they actually work to support themselves. Or they have a husband or a wife who has a real job, and that's how they make money, and that's how they live. For the Sea Organization specifically, they are clothed and fed and birthed, right, and given a place to live by the Sea Organization, and they don't have to deal with any of that stuff. They have to buy underwear and socks and that sort of thing, and their uniforms are always a mess because they don't get enough uniform parts, and there's all kinds of problems, but they do still get uniform parts, and they do still have a place, a roof over their head, and three meals a day that is provided to every single Sea Org member by Scientology. So their salary in the Sea Organization is $50 a week, or actually like $45.16 or something after you take out tax. And that's all they need to, you know, or that's not all they need, but that's all they get to pay for their socks and underwear and shampoo and toothpaste and that sort of thing. Sundries like that, the person has to get themselves. Most of that stuff is provided at low cost in the staff canteen that the Sea Org has for the crew, right, on base there. There's a canteen at Flag, there's a canteen in Los Angeles, and you can go get toothpaste and toothbrushes and stuff like that there, and it's pretty cheap. Or on Sunday mornings when you have your what's called CSP or your laundry time, you wash all your clothes and you go down to the local grocery store. If you need to get a haircut, you get a haircut and that sort of thing, and that's where you pick that stuff up. So that's pretty much how that works. And it's time for Flash Answers. David Schlesinger. Tom Cruise and Kirstie Alley are clear examples of the upper echelon of what a serious Scientologist is made of. Tom Cruise is likely working on his fourth marriage, while Kirstie Alley seems to have an ongoing battle with her weight in the arena of Hollywood. If I were to ask this question to a serious Scientologist, what would they say? How can two of the most prominent and clear Scientologists battle with everyday problems that people who have never even experienced the Church of Scientology easily maintain and overcome? Many people can overcome a weight issue. Some people who have never read Dianetics have been married for 30 years or more. How positive and constructive can the Church of Scientology really be? Okay, well, the Church of Scientology is not positive or constructive in any real way, so it can't really be that positive or constructive. But in terms of how would a serious Scientologist answer this, they wouldn't. They would avoid the question. They would fire out misdirectors, or they would avoid, or they would just go, I don't know, you know, I can't speak for Tom Cruise or Kirstie Alley. And they'd sort of walk away and shluff it off, you know, because they can't let themselves think about this kind of stuff. It's so easy for us out here in the real world to look at these kinds of things and go, contradictions, like, how are you not seeing this? But inside the bubble world, that's how the bubble world works. That's how a destructive cult works, is it shuts down your thinking. So if you ask somebody directly about things like this, like a serious Scientologist, they just avoid. They can't think about it. Because if they start thinking about it too much, the house of cards crumbles. Barbara Miller. Hey, Chris, I was just wondering, when you were traveling around recruiting for the Sea Org, where did you stay in each town? I mean, in California, you would stay in orgs, I suppose? No, we never stayed in orgs. Orgs are not hotels. They don't have places for you to sleep or anything like that. We would stay in hotels. And the Sea Org would pay for our hotel costs. And that's what people who are on Sea Org projects do. Azure Freddy Argent. On the issue of all the personal information that Scientology is keeping on ex-members, has anyone ever tried to get their records from the church? I can imagine the trouble if someone sued to have all their case files turned over to them so they could have it or destroy it. But wouldn't that be an individual's right if they had left the organization? Has anyone ever tried to do that that you know of? You should Google Laura DiCrescenzo. Because her case is the only case I know of where she has successfully sued to receive her PC folders, her confidential auditing folders from the church. And even those that she received were redacted. The church has people sign documents saying that the private confidential files that the church keeps on them, are the church's property. Very, very specifically states that in the contract that you sign before they will start auditing you. So you basically hand over all your rights. There are a number of documents that the church has people sign. This, you know, you would think this would be, again, the sort of thing that would clue somebody in. Like, why would they have to be signing all these documents in order to participate in services that are supposed to be enhancing their life? But they do. And they have to sign a lot of them. There's a whole specific contract about those confidential files. And the church makes it abundantly clear they are the church's property, not yours. So that's how that works. Okay, and we've reached the end of another episode of Critical Q&A. Thank you very much for your questions. And if you have any comments, feedback, or further questions for me, which I'm sure you do, put them in the comments section, and I will keep just getting to them as fast as I can. I'm thinking that next week we might have a bit of an extended show as for the 50th show, and maybe I'll answer some, you know, more questions or something like that, or some big ones. We'll see what I come up with on that. If you haven't checked out my book, please do so, Scientology A to Xenu, An Insider's Guide to What Scientology is Really All About. And thanks for very much for watching, and I'll see you next week.